Aspects relating to fees. That was an option. comments and questions, honourable members? Ms. Smuts.
This is such an important matter. The first option is the Rules Board for Peace of Law, which was a creative proposal, in fact, from the Department of Providers. But we were not satisfied that this was yet answer, and I felt at one point there should be a proper inquiry to look at all the factors, because the situation, as our colleagues in the ADI have described to us, is that we have a situation where many of, especially the smaller attorney firms, don't have work, at the same time we have South Africans saying they can't afford access to justice. And although the reason that suggests itself is fees, and we have in this committee from the start felt that there is something radically wrong with the fees charged for legal services in this country, as indeed the Constitutional Court has said and Judge Wallace has said and so forth. We were still looking for a mechanism to try to get to all the factors, and that's why the further option was drafted, for which I'm very grateful, but I don't feel we're there yet. One thing I'd like to point to is a certain amount of purple prose, if you'll forgive me. I don't think what they say in 4A, the current untenable situation in terms of which access to legal services is not a reality for most South Africans. Am I right? Surely you don't say untenable in the law. And there are further examples deeper down. But it also seems to me that we must find a way to allude to some factors. For example, it seems to me clear that the rules made by the two professions, the bar rules and the side bar rules, are in themselves sometimes restrictive and anti-competitive. Is there no way to write that in so that one of the things that this mechanism will go look at is the rules? In B, I thought we should say the following, rephrase it. Remember now that the clause says the council must within 2 years, I'm reading at 4 from the top, the council must within 2 years after the commencement of chapter 2, the council must investigate and report back to Parliament or the Minister with recommendations on the following, taking into account best international practice and so forth. Then A is the current situation, which we should rephrase, actually it's not a reality. Then B, to report back to Parliament or the Minister on a mechanism most desirable in the context of this Act, which will be responsible for determining the fees or tariffs payable to all legal services. The establishment of such a mechanism, its composition and processes should ideally follow, taking into account the competition laws of the Republic and the views of the Competition Commission. Now all that stuff after that I think should simply come out. I don't think we should write in the Competition Commission, which upholds the principle that it is undeniable and unacceptable, blah, blah, blah. Surely that's not appropriate. But it also seemed to me that we should maybe say, start off B, with a question whether a mechanism should be created to fit fees, because that's a question. Shouldn't we allow the market to operate once they looked at all the factors? I don't think we should say that a mechanism should be set up, which will determine fees and tariffs. My thinking rather was that they first should look at the whole terrain and the factors, and then decide whether a mechanism is necessary. If so, what it should be. And I think in this context, the Steve Swart edition should not appear. The subsection C, I think, is the same as the opt-out. The desirability and feasibility of allowing users of legal services the opportunity to voluntarily agree to pay lots and lots of money. I'm not sure it's appropriate in this context. It was appropriate in the first option. That, I don't know how intelligible that was, but it seems to me we're not there yet. I do prefer the second option, but it seems to me we're not quite there yet.
Just before you respond, I know that this comes as a result of discussions within the committee. I'm just wondering, because I've read this further option, reading it, it looks like the preamble to a bill. And I wonder, Ms. Lowe and Ms. Dyer, Ms. Susanna, whether could look at encapsulating this in a encapsulates the principles contained in 4, A, B, and C. So that, yes, there is some kind of investigation into this matter, very important. And, best international practices, public interest, all that is very important. I'm not sure that it should be said as much there. We understand that that's all that's going to be taken into consideration. But it seems like it's not where this should be. And maybe there's just one or two succinct clauses that could be found to capture this. I realize I'm asking a hell of a lot of you. Yes, we should.
Chair, I'm in agreement with Honourable Dean Smuts on her proposal that we need to look at this, and depending on what option is followed, will then result in the subsidy that I suggested that is appropriate. I also just wanted to ask whether we have sufficiently covered the issue of the contingency fees in terms of the Contingency Fees Act that I raised previously, and I don't think we've actually looked at that. And that might give credence to the fact that you're not in a position to determine the first alternative option, and that the whole issue of an investigation over a period that would look at that act as well might be appropriate, as well as depending High Court litigation or Constitutional Court litigation relating to common law agreements relating to litigious matters. My point here was on non-litigious matters. So I think, Chair, we just need to consider that when we finally decide on what options we need to do. But at this stage, I don't think we cover the issue of contingency fees in terms of the Contingency Act at all. And I think that was raised by a Competition Commission. They suggested that a provision be included dealing with the fate of contingency fees and that act. And our note, the department's note, was this does require attention and is perhaps an issue that should be included in the bill. So a broader look at the issue of the package.
Thank you, Chair. Mine is just a comment in terms of the specs of what we propose. Firstly, I think if the committee goes ahead with the first option of having the rules board in a structured way, determining the mechanism for dealing with fees. And in the light of the very same point, which was part of what the minister articulated to the president for the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court at the issue of rules, the minister already indicated that the rules board will be reviewed within 2 years after coming to operation of the Supreme Court Act. So which means 2 years within 2015. Now, by 2015 there will be a new rules board and a mechanism for the termination of fees, which may not be the effect mechanism ever get. And it will be a process undertaken by the minister. Now, the option for says the council must review, must undertake an assessment within 2 years after they come into office. Now the council, if we anticipate that a lot of this bill will be promulgated from January 2014, will mean that it will come into place in 2016, and it will have 2 years by 2018 to bring in mechanism. And there are two options. Either, well, by that time there will already be a mechanism by the rules board. We may be kind of wait the section to reflect that the council may undertake a investigation and look into the appropriateness of the established mechanism. Not start, but by that time there will be mechanism. So the council may have to see the effectiveness or efficiency of the mechanism. But that needs to be further concerned. All I'm just saying is that we should not create the impression that a mechanism can only be determined in 2018. It will be too late for people to get access to justice.
and two is with allied government, because the minister has a responsibility in terms of this act and the Supreme Court to come with something within 2 years. So there will be something in place in 2015. And the council may enhance whatever is in place by the time. It's a good catch. So the wording must then tie up with the process so that we don't get the impression that it will be justice fair. People can only be able to access justice in 2018.
What Mr. Kosana says, does that mean he's suggesting that you should have the present first alternative in addition to the further option, a slightly redrafted? Yeah, but you do want it in this act, that the rules board must look at non-litigious fees. You do want it. You say it follows also automatically from the Superior Court, but it would be needed in here, wouldn't it?
Even if from the discussion head, we've said the rules, the thinking that the rules board in its reform character will also be responsible for the fee, determining the rules whatever. And we thought that those powers, etc., will come in the relevant act, the rules board act, or amendment of the rules board act, or what as and when the rules board come into operation. So this can only be cross-reference. It was not necessarily given their power. They are the very same concept of cross-reference we made this record set, so that they don't derive their powers from a set act. Or they are not limited when we do the process, because we could find our powers in this act. When the process comes into place, it is what caused us to unveil this act and to see whether this act is amended. So can this kind of recognize a process as a cross-reference, then there will be different different process that would then allow the various options and ventilation of views for to crystallize.
The nicer part of what Mr. Sander is saying is that it would be 2018 before a further option could kick in, and that there's paralysis until then, and we all know the situation is, it is in fact untenable, even though that word might be purple prose in the context of a statute. So what's persuasive about what he's saying is that it sounds as though it will be tabled anyway, an amendment to the rules board will be tabled anyway for this committee to deal with, and that therefore, and what persuades me is the timescale you describe quite rightly. So then we would be saying that in the further option that they must investigate and report back basically the efficacy of, how are you going to say it, of measures in respect of non-litigious fees. Okay, so it does need a redraft, but we're going to end up doing only further option.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Yeah.
In support of the suggestions, Chair. And then in terms of development of mechanisms for most desirable fees, Honourable Smart had actually indicated maybe the fact that you don't need to insert the views of the Competition Commission. Was it not put down as fear that maybe the mechanism that is actually being used could actually to some extent maybe contradict the views of the Competition Commission? I think we need to revisit that. And Honourable Swart made mention of the Contingent Fees Act. We need to really clearly look at it so that it doesn't actually water down your mechanism of development of most desirable fees.
I think, Chair, the sub 3 relates to non-litigious. Now, all the purpose of the law is set for litigious matters to protect and protect parties, and at the moment there is no tariff stand. There was a strong suggestion both on the Competition Commission that something needs to be dealt with relating to contingency fee, as well as from various big law firms such as Adams and Adams that said they deal with intellectual property rights, and their clients are multi-billion multinationals that are prepared to pay huge fees so that their intellectual properties can be registered. And in such circumstances, their clients are prepared to pay the increased amount, and it's not litigation. So I think that is the distinction between them, and that is why they asked that we should insert a clause to that effect, that the client can on its own, in non-litigious matters, those are non-court case matters, where you go to an attorney to register an intellectual property, a patent or something like that, and you're prepared to pay, because for you as a company, or acquisitions and mergers, that's worth billions of rands, and you're prepared to pay for the fees. And particularly where we look at multinational law firms, it's in the interest of our economy that we should have a clause to that effect. Our main concern when we look at protection of consumers is when it comes to litigation, and that has been the big complaint in all the newspaper articles, that people can't afford to litigate, to go to court to protect their rights. So I think that is the distinction I was trying to make, and I think that is important, that's why we emphasize the use of non-litigious matters. Up to now, we've got the tariffs for the litigious matters. That only covers, however, party and party costs. We're going one further, and we're going to cover attorney and client costs as well,
yes,
in litigious matters, which at the moment is not regulated at all. Thank you.
That's really the hardest job.
Yeah.
Really the job.
I think it's appropriate what Honourable Swart is saying. If our impression of patenting has got to do with big companies, because we might actually find that it's just an ordinary man in the street who's just come up with an idea and they want to patent things, how are we going to actually ensure that we protect them so that they could be in the position to participate in this arena?
We're not saying that they are obliged to charge a higher fee. It's the client's interest, the client. We are saying here, read carefully what we're saying, it's at his or her own initiative. Nothing in the section precludes any user of saying, I'm prepared to pay a higher fee. They don't mean much, because they must charge me less. So it's in that context that we're saying, we're not saying that from the attorney's side, that the attorney can charge you a higher fee. We're saying from the client side, I'm prepared to pay more. Clearly, in a smaller situation like that, the client will pay the fee, because if you look at 35.1, fees in respect of legal services, litigious and non-litigious. So there's a tariff or effect for non-litigious matters. Here we are saying, but in certain circumstances, the user, the client, the multinational, can come prepared to pay more. But a smaller user will say, I'm not prepared to pay more. I want the tariff, instead of 35.1. So I think to a certain degree it is covered. But I think we do need to bear in mind we are in a global economy, and that some users of legal services, complex legal services, multinational companies, law firms, we need to not find ourselves out of the market, because it could be to the detriment of our own legal firms in that situation. But definitely, I hear the concerns of my colleague, and I think it is covered, because the tariff will then apply to that user of those legal firms, of that legal cost. But it's something we need to engage upon. So thanks for those comments.
All right, I've got other hands, Ms. Sutz, Ms. Kedaya, Silkstone, okay.
That fits perfectly with what I wanted to say. That's absolutely the case, and we can simply look at the section in the Competition Commission's submission. I agree. And it's the same point I wanted to make in respect of this e-swart exception. We must allow the market to operate. I mean, everything that is wrong, in my view, is the result of distortions of the market. And if you must allow an attorney to charge less than the fee set, you will get more business that way. That's how the market works. And at the same time, you must allow clients to say that they're perfectly happy to pay quite some pocket money because they've got quite some pocket money. And that's also the free market operates. So a complete agreement with Silverstone, and the point is well made.
Thank you, Chairperson. So, just for the purposes of us redrafting, the sense I get, Janice, correct me if I don't have it right, is that the committee is swaying towards the further option, and what we will capture there is succinctly as suggested are the key principles that the committee has interrogated, without having to refer to the Competition Commission or competition laws. Principles that fall into this area of fees and the issue of all of these various aspects will be captured in those key principles and worked through in a much fresher, smarter, not so verbose language. And so we'll just revamp a further option to give effect to that. Thank you.
What are you going to say about the reference to the Contingency Act? Because clearly we will have to, that is binding at the moment for litigious matters that you can negotiate, I think it's up to 25% or something. So that is existing law. We would need to find a way of making reference to the existing law, or we need to deliberate on that. Depending what option we follow. If we follow option one, then when setting the term in the tariff of taking into account the inputs, and then you might need to put another E, the provisions of the Contingency Act. But if we're going to do an investigation, then it will be investigate the contingency of the provisions of the Contingency Act. So you need to just put that into both options. There is a reference to that, and otherwise it's a vacuum. Are you following, Mr. Guy? Are you in agreement with that? I'm trying to please out that there's no reference to that act at the moment.
I thought we were going to discuss a further option.
Yes.
But with reference to the 6-5 clause,
yes.
In addition, give people the right to start with.
Okay. So then it will be, because then it will be a broad investigation of all the fee structures, and that will include the contingency as well. You don't have to make mention of that.
Well, now are we all okay with that? Good.
Before we talk of the fees, this provision, I just wanted to bring to your attention the discussion we had with the DG. And on second reflection, I think that discussion belongs to that the determination of the votes. The DG had said that asked that we converse with the committee the need to put a clause in the underpinnings that will allow the minister to determine maximum fees for certain categories of legal services. And the view was looking into how certain fees across government are charged.
Favored by
the state. You get the same kind of job in different departments, paid for numbers in one department, and SC can charge you to file a plea in a matter or notice to defend and charge $75,000 and 2 pages, whatever. They appear and whatever. So there's so much informality. And government departments are vulnerable to those who charge the fees. Now there was a thinking that we have that in every clause that we see the minister may fix whatever, and they wanted that the DGP said that the clause will help start managing the fee from the perspective. So I get a sense that if the commission is very strong that that may interfere with the approach being taken, we can put it here and this further elaboration of in to be part of the comprehensive review. But we wanted just it open that the minister made in respect of services, legal services for the state determined upon as a for the structure of the state payable full stop. They wanted to check how can themselves with their land set by them spending the balance in the Gazette.
Yes.
If the countries of fees which are probably not in the Gazette, whatever, etc. Obviously it helps everybody, even the state partners to use this as a guideline. But it may even help ordinary people understand, because you may come and question, but if you are in government so much, what do you charge me double, or what do you charge double? So it may help that normalizing the environment, because people charge different fees depending on the person who serves the case. But I'm just putting that because we have a clear mandate from the DG to convert in the committee.
There has been a very strong sentiment against the minister determining any fees. Now I can hear, I understand what Mr. Kusan is saying for government departments, but it's just, and it's a new concept that has come to that we need to deliberate on. I understand there's a broader issue here, and that is the problem that government departments are not using the attorney's office. They are using other attorneys. So we appreciate the department is looking into the whole issue of government litigation services in general, and that might be a better place to look at this whole issue. But you might pick up problems with the Competition Commission, even though you are now determining that government departments will be accepted. You're still using private practitioners, and you then are, again, you might run foul of the competition. I don't know, this is the first I've heard of this. I can appreciate that we need to save the fisc, but a lot of the problem of departments being charged different rates by different attorneys or advocates because they're not using the state attorney. They've got set guidance. The state attorney is one body. And we find that, in my experience, that some departments are not using the state attorney for whatever reason. And they're using private attorneys at massive fees that the government is in charge of. So we need to look at other issues as well that are contributing to the dilemma that you're faced with. I, at first glance, am not in favour of the minister determining fees, a fee structure, even for government departments. I think we are looking at report back. There will be a set tariff after 2 years. Now, we're talking about litigation purposes. That's what you said in particular. Now, we've got a set tariff already for litigation purposes. So I don't know how attorneys can charge different fees, and that they must, or applicants, for those set litigation costs. We've got to set, the Rules Board has already got that. So I think we need to look a bit more general about this. I'm not opposed to what Jamie's saying, but we need to look very carefully because of the sentiment that has been expressed both from the Competition Commission and other bodies as to where the minister is setting fees that impacts upon competition and, of course, possibly on the independence of the legal profession. So I'd leave it at that, Chair.
Okay.
And then it's
Adam.
Thanks, Chair. I do support the view of Honourable Swart that maybe the department should actually utilize the state attorneys. And in the event that they have to use external attorneys, maybe for specialized cases, then it means that they've got to get special permission of the minister. I guess you need to make amendments to the act. Your consent with the DG.
Chairperson, I don't understand if the request is a maximum fee structure be set for state legal services, why is it different for ordinary citizens? Because at the end of the day, the State Department is also a client. And so, on the one end, we say that the council must establish a mechanism to determine fees and tariffs for ordinary citizens, but when it comes to state departments, which is also clients, we say that maximum fees should be set. Doesn't it then boil down to the whole thing of ultimately setting a maximum fee for all clients, irrespective of whether you're a government department or whether you're an ordinary citizen, and then allow the attorneys and advocates to maneuver underneath that maximum fee?
Chair, in my mind, the falling is what I understand. That the further option will be expanded to incorporate all of the principles that the committee is deliberating, including as J.B. Sasana is saying, without it being restrictive, the investigation will include the possibility of the capping of fees, whether limited to state partners or otherwise. So without even being definitive about what we want to achieve, the principle in my mind is what we want to add in, and all that we're simply saying is, in your overall investigation that option two talks to, please consider the issue of capping of fees, whether it's state departments or generally, consider that as the other area of focus, without being descriptive as to how that process is going to end up. Please include it in the brief. And as long as we include that principle, I don't think we're compromising any existing law, and it's going to be a wide investigation. So, exactly the point that Mr. Adam talks about, and what Mr. Adams talks about, and what Mr. Sana speaks to, would capture by the principle. So I think we're all on the same page, without anyone's concerned about even the contingency sphere with respect to what the Hong Kong says, it's an investigation. And it doesn't even then deal with that technical issue as to whether the minister should or shouldn't, because the committee will know that the Legal Aid Board, Legal Aid South Africa, has a prescribed tariff. Mm-hmm. And what they simply do is they devise a tariff. This is our tariff. We have a roster of attorneys that are applying to participate in our jury case system. If you don't like it, please, don't apply. You like it, here's the fee, pay for it. So I actually see, in my mind, the state being in a position to have a tariff similar, because the Legal Aid SA is part of the state structure. So this is, you know, but ask them.
I'm
agreement with Mr. Dye on the sentiment to consider this, and I think that is a way forward. But there's a huge difference between criminal cases and Sandrail's multi-billion rand, 20 billion rand case that they are lodging, where they used, I think, 5 silks or something. Now, in that case, because you're dealing with multi-billions of rands, they've got the top advocates available, and it's in the state interest that they have access to that. So you have your gauntlets, you have your, and in that situation, surely the state is the biggest litigant in civil matters in the country. And it is in the interest of the taxpayer that, and I'm not preempting what may be found. I'm saying let's put that clause in, I'm in agreement. Let's consider that. But I want to just give the other side of it. Legal Aid deals with only criminal cases. If they have a high court matter, they'll have an advocate, and that might be at an agreed tariff. But when you're dealing with your massive contracts that the government is involved in, we've got a national budget of 1 trillion rand. It's 1,000 billion. So you've got lots of contracts that are being negotiated, that are being litigated with multi-billions of rand. I know, because I was involved in that. And when I was involved, my client, the State Department, would say, I want the best lawyers available to win this case. Now, if you constrain that with a tariff, you might not necessarily be able to afford your top lawyers. A National Treasury, for example, in the Sandrail case, is using Jeremy Compton and others. So we've got to be very careful to constrain our executive. And I'm speaking on the part of government now. But I don't want to preempt the arguments and what such inquiry will come about. Let's look at our own president, for example, when he was facing corruption charges. He made use of the best advocate possible. And surely, government should also be entitled on a market basis to use the best advocates possible. If you end up having a tariff for, say, for advocates that appear in civil litigation, you will not be able to define whether it's a multi-billion rand international contract with Sandrail is, or the building of the Huguenot Tunnel. There was a lot of litigation about that. You know, just to give examples where your clients are entitled as state departments to have the best advocates. But I think the broader issue here is that we're purely saying let's look into the issue. I don't want to preempt anything,
But I do also think that it raises the broader issues of state litigation, which the department is looking into in a broader policy perspective. And maybe that issue can be raised at that stage. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, I think it's actually sensible for us to actually come up with a system that allows government departments, when they've got matches that are supposed to be litigated, for them to get the specialized services of the best legal representation. But at the same time, control measures should be there. You need to, so it doesn't become a runaway train. Yeah, so I do agree with Honorable Swan, but what is important is how do you then put control measures? That's what needs to be looked at.
I'm so glad you've made the point, Mr. Jaffa, because you can't not agree with Mr. Swart. I've heard a minister make the point that she came to me and said, well, I'm forced to go for the best. But this was in relation to briefing patterns and the use of the lawyers as second, third, and fourth chairs. And I said, we grant you that. We grant you that. But you see, Mr. Swart, this is the problem. There's danger that you may be faced with a runaway train, 5-6. That particular Department of State on the NC may say that I'm justified to look at the amount of money involved, look at what's at risk if we lose. And so, you know, they may be able to justify it, but I think the concern emanating from the Ministry is that in some matters, it may have gone out of control. And afterwards, they sat back and looked at it and said, they could have done without those 2-6. You see, and by then, of course, it's too late. You see, you're faced with 81. This is my bill, Penny.
I think we've said balance, and I think that's what such an inquiry would bring about. So, okay, just to say, the issue about the muscles, that wasn't one part.
Sure.
No, no. Government was represented.
Yes.
No. The principle remains in that.
Yeah, I understand that, but I think the concern coming from the ministry, and I'm not speaking behalf of the ministry, I listened to what Ms. Susanna said, and I gather that there is a concern, and perhaps we need to be briefed about where things did go out of hand, and in that situation, what does the minister do? Because the DG is simply expected to pay. You remember they sat in front of us across the way in that committee room above the NCOB chambers and said, we're faced with a situation where state departments simply say, here's the bill, pay. And they pay. They only came back after 10, 15 years, if that. So is that feasible as well? We have to think about that. All right.
Thanks, Chair. And I think it came in the context, let's take in the context. And perhaps a better approach may be to recognize the option that has been to basically come with a provision which is subject to such interests may be taken in terms of contemplating this section, blah, blah. The minister may issue guidelines to cap certain categories of fees. We will do that. You are not waiting for people to finish working the state until you come point. You basically provide an interim measure. And when you say may, all those things will be taken into account. And I do not want to flag most of the other spaces the government, but you'll also appreciate that we are government has been taken to the National Court on a matter where legal representatives are being engaged in fees to perform the very same function that government has spent by others to perform. Now, you start a commission, you establish a team of lawyers, you go to your profession and say, this is a commission, I've got the best in this area. Until the best, you put them there and say, go and open investing for me. After you put your 6 or 7, 8 of the best for which the state has paid for them, when the matter starts, then others come on the sideline. They all say, you know, but want to assist the best, and you must be paid for assisting the best. Then what was the need at the certain point to get a team of lawyers from the best who know this environment. Now, when the commission starts, when the chairperson of the Arms Procurement Commission says, no, look, the only people we are allowed to ask questions and examine are the ones which are asked the commission whatever, whilst you've got the room half full of the other guests who are going to sit down, they're not asked to do anything whatever, and they get paid. And all those are kind of challenges that faces becoming the process. But you are able, if you put up certain categories and put the caps whatever, there's nothing wrong with getting people to do a matching brief or whatever, but that can allow the minister to then say, if you want to provide the service, and whatever, this is up to how much government can pay, so that we are not vulnerable to the legal profession. Now, a provision that could basically unstate the future, but also provide measures now to address something whatever it may assist taking us forward. Besides.
Chairperson, capping of fees will not result in getting the best lawyer. Because you cannot tell me as a lawyer I must charge 10 rands, but you want me being the best lawyer. Because then I'm going to say to you, as being the best lawyer, I'm not available. And then you're going to come back to me and say, okay, I'm prepared to increase the fees until you become available. So capping of fees will not result in getting the best lawyers. And we must remember who is requesting the services, who is in need of the services. Ultimately, it is the client, it is the government department, it is the ordinary citizen. So if you want the best lawyers, you need to make sure that they get the money that they want. Otherwise, they will simply say, I'm not available. And then you will not get the best lawyer. So this whole thing of capping of fees will not... I do agree that lawyers at times take advantage of government departments because there's a lot of money. I do agree with that, and I do agree that something should happen with that. But we must also keep in mind, it's not the lawyer going to the government department to provide services. It's actually the government department that comes to the lawyer and says, I need your services. So who is asking whose services? We must just keep that in mind. So I do understand this whole debate, but I'm just concerned that it seems like it's a debate because of sour grapes. Our government departments are not happy because of all the monies that they have spent with lawyers. Of course, they got the services, but now, and we all agree, it's a lot of money. But now, after the fact, we want to change the structure. At the end of the day, I'm just concerned that if we do cap the fees, we will not get the best lawyers that's available.
Difficult ones. Mr. Swati,
I just want to give an example, not a matter that I was involved in, but a matter that had severe consequences for the state, and that related to policemen off duty committing crimes and the state then being held civil liable. And a senior junior was in the SC, and the court came out and said after many hearings that the state must be held liable in the particular circumstances of that matter, which set a new principle. And I don't understand in that circumstance why an SC with the principle involved was not used for the minister, because the implications of that case now for civil liability going forward is huge. It's billions of rand. So it just illustrates to me, and I'm not imputing the ability of that senior junior, but I was flabbergasted when I heard that only a junior was used in that particular sense. And he might have been used, he might have had another junior with him, two juniors probably. But it just highlights to me the need. We have matters of huge consequences of the state. The state being a deep pocket for litigation purposes. It's like insurance company that we need to be very wary. And I'm in total agreement with Lizelle, with the Honourable Lizelle, that it's difficult. How do you strike that balance? Because you've got a market of, and if you want a top advocate, and particularly if you want a top black advocate as well, that are in high demand, and regrettably the pool is increasing. You tend to pay. So I think the suggestion by Mr. Dye to look into this, we're not, you know, I think I'm not in favour of any interim measure until such an inquiry has come out. Because that's son was to say we need to put some interim measure. We can't preempt something. We need to have the investigation to look into the whole issue of costs, and then for them to come back. As soon as you start saying that as an interim measure, you're going to have every minister come into you and say, how can you do this all? Now, because you're tying our hands. National Treasury will be the first one. You know, but I think I understand the need to strike the balance. But as Rizal said, when you want the best advocate and it's a multi-billion rand contract, you need to pay for that. You need to pay for that. And regrettable as it is, and we'd be shocked at the day fees, we talk about 45,000 per day. Can even be higher, you know. So that is something that we need to look at, but as part of this inquiry, as part of the whole issue, the broader departmental inquiry into state litigation, that broader inquiry that is taking place, might be at some stage you amend the State Attorney's Act to prohibit departments. A lot of unnecessary fees are incurred by them using private attorneys.
Mm.
That is not necessary. You've got a state attorney's office, and if they're not doing their job properly, they must be jacked up. But the state can save so much money, they don't need to pay for an attorney's fee. Those fees are free. Free. And in fact, if the state attorney wins a case, they recover fees for the fiscal.
Mm.
If they lose a case, they don't charge the department client their fees. Now, a state department that goes to a private attorney, even if they lose the case, they still can pay the attorney. So I don't understand why departments are not in the state attorney's office. And that is a political issue that one needs to look into. So these are, I think, very useful, broad discussions on an issue that JB quite correctly has brought to our attention and needs to be looked at. But how we find it, is, I think that is what the option will look at, to look into this whole issue of the whole fee structure.
I thought Ms. Bilal Jack put her finger on it when she said you would need to get a State Attorney's Act.
Yeah.
And if necessary, bring changes there. But
yes, just to say that indeed all the submissions are good and correct.
Mm.
At the end of the day, the state fixes must actually be protected. But at the same time, when the matter is litigated, the state should be in the position to get the best. And of course, we have the state attorney's office that needs to be used, but where external legal representatives needs to be procured, there's got to be control measures. And the big question was then, how do we do it? Because you are suggesting ministerial approval, which is in the only
room. We'll look at your question there, Mr. Dyer. This discussion has been very necessary and fruitful. You see, it gets to the heart of when people ask, why do you need a school? You see, if you're sitting quietly outside and listen to this discussion, it is every bit of this discussion set up why you need it.
Just one other factor that I would imagine in any case the committee in the investigation would look at would be the factors of a mandatory written agreement on fee arrangements. We've seen this in developed jurisdictions.
Yes.
And it's one of the other issues that we will factor in, because the whole issue and if you interrogate the complaints that come before the Law Society, the heart of that is the absence of fee agreements. Tony says, that's not what we agreed on, that's not how I understood it.
Yes.
It goes to the heart of it, and that issue will also be factored into the investigation as to whether it will also, one of the recommendations could be mandates to fee agreements.
Yes.
You know, so yes. I'm just putting that there as well.
Yes. Yes. No, because you know, ordinary mining streets, I understand the major corporations, I mean, they don't really have this. Well, they have an agreement.
They have an agreement.
So it's irrelevant. A person coming out of the township, I think up front they should be informed, as Mr. Dyer says, look, this is what you're facing financially. So at the very least, the person knows, okay, well, either I can or I can't afford it. And then they proceed on that basis. But what usually happens, Mr. Guy, is that they're told way down the line, and by then, oh my God, you know, second bonds and overdrafts and borrowing from the extended family and all manner of problems.
So there's a nice example in one of the research papers, I forget now whether it's Canada, Ireland, or maybe even Oz, but I mean there are plenty of precedents. Just a nice simple clause.
Yes.
There must be,
yes.
People will know where they stand. It must be set out in writing. And perhaps we could find that, I think it's in the paper on the commission. The last bit.
Yes, probably. Right. Okay. Anything else on 35? Oh yes, certainly. So.
The next new amendment was in clause 37 that deals with the establishment of disciplinary bodies. A new one big A was inserted. Shall I read through it?
I guess, yes, all the salient points.
Okay. It says in the old one, the council must be necessary establish investigating committees to conduct investigations. The new 1A says an investigating committee may direct any legal practitioner or employee to produce a book, etc., providing that the investigation committee may make copies, etc. And then in B, it may not refuse. And in C, any person who performs any function may not disclose any information which he has obtained, except in those instances pointed out there. This is just a power to the investigating committee to obtain information.
And there's, oh, this is an alternative to paragraph B, eh?
Yes. Paragraph B says that the legal practitioner might not refuse, and then the alternative is, this is in sub 2 then, sub 2B.
Sub
2B would then read, an investigating committee must, after investigating a complaint, if it is satisfied that the legal practitioner may, on the basis of prima facie evidence, be guilty of misconduct, that in terms of the code of conduct warrants misconduct proceedings, and refer the matter to the council for adjudication by a disciplinary committee, or the complaint should be dismissed on the grounds that the misconduct does not necessarily warrant.
Okay. Honourable members? This sucks.
I think that a reference should be built in here to the relevant regions in your own draft law. Complaints are lodged with the regional councils. There are references to that, and I'm sorry, I haven't made a list of the relevant clause numbers. There's reference to, I think, a kind of an assumption, which is only sensible, that the disciplinaries will occur at the regional council level. And yet, this investigation clause is written for the central council. So is it your intention to centralize investigation portion? So your complaint is lodged at the regional council, so it's not your intention that the investigation occurs at the central level. Well, then that should be so written, because it isn't. It isn't.
Chair, I think the intention is that this might be delegated, but we leave the option to the council to delegate. But it can be delegated. But it is lodged with the region, supposedly for convenience.
You can't leave it up in the air and delegate or not. It must be clear. If it's lodged with the region, do you want it then to be sent to a central spot? for the investigation. I'm sure you can make an argument for that. It's better that the local people who all know each other don't do the investigating. But then I would think at minimum that it must go from there, automatically goes to the relevant region. Various things that you've got in here, for example, it must be accessible to the public, the hearing, for example. It's, you know, it just makes sense that the disciplinary should occur in the very same region where the misconduct occurred. But then it should be made clear here. It can't be a matter of discretionary determination.
This again lends itself to the concept of set of chambers at a regional level, and again to, and I know we have finalized that debate, but Mr. Dyer's suggestion that there is that ability for the regions to set up subcommittees, whatever you want to call them. My concern with the wording as it is now is the council is only going to meet four times a year. Now how is it going to, when necessary, appoint a committee of three persons, which I'm opposed to? I think we need to only have an investigating person, four persons, when it's a substantial issue. But it definitely does need to be delegated up, because there are so many, thousands of complaints that are laid. I see the option. And it is there, a point to designate. Now, at its quarterly meetings, and I appreciate we've got the issue of there is a interim body, the expo we wear this one, so it would have to be delegated down.
Yes, I think that makes sense.
You know,
so we see the expo dealing with that.
Even expo, but to the regional level, because they're the ones that are getting it, and surely
there's so many of them.
Yeah, and they, but surely one needs to insert it at this level already, that we need. It must be at that level. If we don't, again, we need to make this watertight. We need to look very carefully, because we don't want legal practitioners to say our formulation is open to review. Besides the merits, remember my argument about procedure as opposed to the merits, that we've got to make sure it is watertight. At the moment, it's been done at the provincial statutory level. Now we send it up to the region to send it back again, to delegate it down, but we need to make it very clear that there is that, and that principle of delegare delegatus non part est, which says it can only delegate at a certain level. At the moment, we are saying the council can either appoint a committee or appoint a designated person that they then are going to have to, and we're going to have to put in a delegation power there somehow.
Thanks, Chair.
I think it may actually be easier when you discuss it in under separate chambers at regional level, functions thereof. There could probably be other delegated responsibilities that you may actually look at as part of the functions of these separate regional chambers.
Yes, let me just say one thing. We've now not dealt with clause 36 because it doesn't have any double underlinings. But let me just say at this point, because it forms part of the debate, we obviously are not in favour of 36 as it stands, which asks the council to develop a single code of conduct that applies to all legal practitioners. We still recognise the two professions. It follows that each profession will make its own code of conduct that is intrinsic to its power of self-regulation. From my point of view, it follows that there should be the two chambers also at the top. And it is, interestingly, the position of the General Council of the Bar, if you will look at their submission, that they are happy to make their codes of conduct after consulting the other chamber. They're happy to have that much cross-pollination, but each one of them makes its own code of conduct. So that's the starting point. Then when we get to the disciplinaries, because the disciplinaries occur under the code of conduct. The code of conduct sets your standard. It's when a person infringes the code of conduct that the disciplinary investigation and the disciplinary follows. Now, what's interesting about that is that the way the bill is written, the disciplinary committees, which necessarily have to be at regional level, consist of one advocate, one attorney, one layperson. And interestingly, that doesn't seem to me to be in discord with the positions of, if I remember correctly, either the advocates or the attorneys. They all seemed to accept, but I will recheck, the disciplinaries could occur under multidisciplinary committees. And I think there may very well be virtue in that. If you think of some of the submissions we had, where one instructing attorney refused to testify against the advocate who was up for misconduct. So I think there might be virtue in that. But just to recap on the whole matter of the two chambers, you need the two chambers at the central level, each to write its own conduct. They appear to be happy to do a bit of consulting. Then the disciplinaries for infringement of those codes of conduct, in my view, obviously go down to the regional councils, where, on my reading, people are not unhappy with the idea of disciplinary committees, which include, in fact, both disciplines.
Okay. Mr. Dyer.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would urge the Commission to consider the following issues in its deliberations. And the one issue then relates to the code of conduct as contained in clause 36. What the department envisages is a very simple code of conduct for legal practitioners with sections in it applicable to the relevant branch of the legal profession. So there's a chapter that says advocates. One is code of conduct, and when it's done, they will see that the difference is in the related trust account. And of course, the 34-year issue, if you choose not to be an advocate, would be effectively self-certificate. So it's a code of conduct for legal practitioners or all officers of court, and there will be a chapter dealing with the 34-year profession. So the response from the department is simplistic. To justify no justification for a set of chamber at an entrenched level, except that in considering the various issues, what the committee has considered is that there could be specialist committees at a regional level or at any level to deal with issues that are peculiar as and when they do arise, and there is absolute room within the bill for that to be created. And then, insofar as the issue relating to how the discipline bodies are to be constituted and whether there should be original powers in this bill to a regional council dealing with discipline, the committee needs to consider that in developing the various regions, they will develop as the bill and as the needs arises, and what could be envisaged is a duplication of what currently exists within the confines of the financial balances. And as the bill develops with years, there could very well be regional councils in every province, and depending on how the money is available for that. Because ideally, I would imagine that could enhance access to justice and the way in which the regions are going to structure, because I think that process will need time to settle itself. But if you have a delegated power at a national level, and we know that practically it's going to automatically be delegated to the processes and for times, it makes the accountability of the entire legal profession and to the man on the street that reads the bill to know that irrespective of where this attorney or advocate is practicing, I have a central point at which I can lodge a complaint. I don't have to be confused about that. And they do it, and the central office immediately knows into which area the relevant practitioner is involved, because practitioners themselves are operating throughout the country with offices in every province. And when you get admitted as an officer of the court, you're an officer of the High Court of South Africa, and you don't have to go and get admitted in all of the regions. And those practices will fall away in the way in which attorneys and advocates will be admitted. And so the idea of the bill is to create an advocate and an attorney and a legal practitioner to be an advocate and an attorney of the Republic of South Africa and not of KZN. I think one of the issues that the bill seeks to address is to create that process in the way in which the governance structure is structured. And if it says that the National Council will create these disciplinary bodies and it has the right to delegate, then it simply does so in terms of efficiency. But to give the regional councils original powers takes away the rights from the National Council to decide what is the best way in which it must deal with certain issues. So that is a rationale, and my colleagues can add to that if needs be, as to why it is being designed in that way.
Yes, and we have also wanted to follow the precedent of other similar structures in place. If you can remember how firstly the council will have, in terms of the people have committee. So although the council meets 4 times a year, obviously the committee of the council will have the opportunity to meet and focus on different aspects of the world. But we don't want committees of admission over the council. So we have contingency between. But as and when the broader parliament council meets, then they take a decision, like decisions to appoint the committee. When we look at the JC now, and as I said, to the decision, parliament approves the legislation and says, there shall be a conduct committee that will investigate compliance with the judge. I consistently repeat. So, compliance with the justice, go to the JC, go to the conduct committee, it comes back to the committee of the JC, not the JC. So, there's work between the conduct committee and the judicial committee in terms of that. Then it goes to the JC. When the committee has made the recommendation, it means an all effort to work because the full house of the committee is there, they meet 4 times and they've got specific mandates. When they come to me, they can't meet for 4 days, 5 days or whatever. The assumption is that they work with the, through the committee. So the small committee with the system mechanism working together with the conduct committee. So that there are clear recommendations that comes over to the committee. Now, there are 2 processes, and I think the bill is a comment. It's a, first, the most important is an investment committee, not a person. Because if you go to the committee, it can basically, at that level, make a determination whether this matter require an inquiry. It's not an inquiry. In the case of the judge, the current committee will make a determination whether this matter require is impeachable. It must go to parliament, require a tribunal. So you need a body of people to take a decision at the personal level. Who will get the facts? Who will get the books? Who will inspect? Who will interview people? Not one person. Because if you have got an investigator, you basically further fragment the process. Because an investigator must still come and report to a committee. And if you come, then this one comes to the council and report. That many people who, and the agenda is too long, and they are coming all over the province and the other pressures or whatever, etc. And they have not been as close to the matter as a committee has been. So if you've got a special committee, that's the way. Then that committee, through the structure of the council, will then basically report to the conduct committee or special committee of the country. And the report and the comments from that committee will then come over to the council. Whether, and the council, all the council does is establish a committee on the recommendation. This is CSA tribunal. Go and do the work. It goes back, they go and do the work, it comes back from whatever, it comes back as a recommendation to the bigger council. So we've taken that format of the thing, and we've thought that if you don't have the preliminary committee having the power to decide, you therefore do not need to give them sufficient delegation, because those are basically your hands. They get the things together. They've already committed the interview, whatever, but it's the committee of the council that will have that power, and then they will then comment to JC. And I think perhaps at some point, maybe helpful to create the kind of structure, the entire so that it see how it goes until the end of the end of it. And I fully agree with that our viewers not that we have different processes, because they have to duplicate the very same committee, we have to duplicate the very same levels of evidence. In fact, we have been said when we be consulting judicial, when we spoke about the matters are going to be easiest thing, because we are going to bring them to what we want. We are not going to come with a good correct for magistrate. We are in the open court, which are the same as us, and the people are the same who are here in court. And the outcome is the same, that we want us to justice. But in the code of conduct, we then come to court and say, look, you may have aspects which are specific to judges, those which are only specific to magistrate, and those are specific to judicial office. So we have, in the law provision, aspects specific to advocate, aspects specific to pupils. You can't have a code of conduct that as an advocate you cannot misuse a stipend or a received thing. There will be aspects specific to candidate attorneys. So there will be categories. You don't want to issue different pieces of code of conduct for different people over in the code of conduct. That was the thinking. And instead of creating a uniform system, a specific thing that regulates the profession for the judiciary, they come with those kinds of categories. Now, once we've got that structure, it therefore means that when have to be key to a structure, that's what we call investigation. Because then the council must sit down and make investment committees of advocates only. And must sit down because the commission is in a chain. So we have three or four investment committees going on time because of the nature of the person against whom the commission is made. But if we've got one, which is very inclusive, they are using the inclusive code of conduct, the same evidence of evidence. So that's basically our view, but I think the question may have a point of
view. I've noted, Mr. Kalanichak, just one question from me, Mr. Sosana. Mom Tembu lives in a home state outside Eshowe. She has a complaint against a attorney. Where would she lodge that complaint? Given where she is, that's where she is. And the council sits wherever it's going to sit. We're assuming it's in Johannesburg, but it might be Pretoria. So in that situation, where would Namdem have to get onto a bus or train to Durban, or how would she lodge a complaint? Just help me there.
There will be a regional office of the council in the closer there. That's why the complaint will be lodged. But that complaint, it won't be lodged, investigated, finalized, and disposed of by that office.
Sure.
It will then fill up. Then committees are on up, because they may have to appoint a committee of people who are not working with Arjun Head.
Sure.
Because,
sure.
No, it's fine. I think most of my concerns have actually just been addressed with your input. Though I wanted to comment, and of course, thanks, Steve, for an earlier discussion indicated that you need to change this. If it's not really our intention to ensure that the fusion of the legal profession, the intention of the case, when he talks about the human legal tax.
Well,
the intention of, I actually went back to read the introduction to be sure that we actually doing what I think is the intention of the bill.
No.
Well, the complainant in Lusikisi,
yes.
There's only no difference in Adina's case. Only not to a township man, that's all it is. And they need an assistant.
Mm.
I don't think we must complete lies for the people on the ground.
Yes.
They know that who charges the court has never got the fair time.
Yes.
They don't distinguish between to a candidate attorney, to a deputy judge, to a victim magistrate, to a JP. all they know, they can raise their complaint down that they went to this office and they were robbed off. And I think we must make it simple for the student about. Then within ourselves, we can look. That's what we want, a similar, a uniform kind of approach. And a single point of entry. Because it will take time to educate people between a senior counsel, an advocate, and a candidate party, and a pupil. They all see somebody who has been caught to move to it.
The essential makes the thing similar to the faith, as is also the debate that we had. It's a double, I mean, two chamber and single chamber, like you say. Because really, if we follow the example of the chamber, it makes it simple to say the campaign will be led by a committee and they will. They will investigate it, and when it comes to it, they have done some groundwork.
Yes, obviously.
Yes.
Just another question for me. Are there presently codes of conduct?
Mm-hmm.
No, the legal profession.
Mm-hmm.
There are they easily accessible?
Mm-hmm.
Well, yes, that's courtesy of Mr. Dyer. He accessed it. So can I? On the website. All right. Fair enough.
On the website.
Okay.
What we haven't looked at is that they look at this, remember, this is against Bible, so I said these people self-regulate.
Yeah.
Therefore, I don't even wish to see their codes on that. Mr. Clinton, who cleverly sent it out by you, but he more cleverly, Mr. Dyer, he
looks
it up and read something circular visible, and I took it out of his hands and I read it out all over again. Yes. So then, but look, the whole system is self-regulation.
Sorry, I don't have a proper speaking voice. But you know, as long as the two professions are recognised, who are you to take away their right to create each their own code of conduct? Now, I listen to you with very great interest, but you have a great homogenising ideological point of view. It's because the government, I'm not addressing you, you are legal advisors to the government. Which is, you want, you know, that in theory, your party, Honourable Simeone, wants one judiciary. Actually, I have to tell you, there are such differences between judges and magistrates, I don't think we're going to arrive at that point. Now you want one legal profession. It's a deep homogenizing instinct. It's ideological, I respect it, but it is yours, it is not mine. It is not my point of departure. Life isn't like that, the world isn't like that, there is a place for two legal professions. As we've seen in all of our reading from the research, in every country where they've effected fusion, there is still an advocate profession. There are still bars, because there is and always will be a need for them. I argue, especially in South Africa. So don't take away their right to write their own codes. It's not going to succeed in either sense. And, Chair, I mean, I listened to Mr. Spusan, I was setting out the JSC structure, which I'm quite familiar. But that's not going to work. You have to recognize that you are still recognizing the two professions. Therefore, given each a committee or a chamber at the top, let them each write their own code. They are willing to do it after consultation with the other chamber or committee. You would be very happy with that. Then once the disciplinaries come in, quite obviously, and the misconduct by an advocate is going to be an infringement of the advocate's now uniform rules. Misconduct by an attorney is going to be an infringement of the attorney's rules, which we have looked at in the course of the Competition Commission submission. So the complaints get lodged in the regions, that's what the Act already says. Therefore, clearly at the regional council level. Therefore, I would say if it's an advocate's misconduct, complaint gets lodged with the advocate chamber. With an attorney, it gets lodged with the attorney's chamber. Now the only question is, do they now send it up to the central, Mr. Kusana indicates yes to the Central Legal Practice Council. Let's say for argument's sake it sits in Pretoria just because we'll bring my trust to the United Practices and the infrastructure is there. We know from Mr. Dyer that they receive 8,000 complaints per annum, of which only 200 go to actual hearings. So there you're going to have your legal practice council, multiply the 8,000 by a ballpark for four provinces, since they're still organized in the old South African provinces. So you want a committee similar to the JSC Conduct Committee, which has just been constituted, to look at the 2,000 complaints. I don't think so. I don't think so. So I think you have to rethink it, that your 8,000 complaints in the case of the northern provinces will go to the new regional councils on my schematic. The new regional councils of Limpopo, Mpumalanga, Gauteng, Northwest. So at least you're going to divide the 8,000 complaints by four, and each goes to its own regional council. Moreover, it goes to its chamber of its regional council. Then they must do an investigation. They must have an investigatory committee. And if a hearing is recommended, then a thing gets constituted, which at this point I don't object if we make the disciplinary committees consisting of one advocate, one attorney. I particularly like the lay person. So that's how it's done. And by the way, on the subject of the broad homogenization, I think it's right. The bar councils, the 10 constituent councils, have always made their own rules. They have their own spin on rules. It's healthy. I believe in devolution. So let them, they are happy to do their uniform rules at the central level. But then I say, why not let the bar councils in the provinces and the attorneys in the provinces add their own extra things which govern their conduct?
As long as we understand that all these issues that are still up in the air, we have not agreed to them. There's been no agreement on the idea of the two chains, okay? Lest we are misunderstood. There's been a little joke, it was Miss Adams, football Miss Adams. I've almost forgotten that you had your hand up way back when.
I also forgot that you. Chair, I might be dumping the gun or I might be missing this point, but I also see, well, it's about the time period for lodging a complaint.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really written somewhere, even though if you look at clause 38, it talks about the council must establish the rules for how for the procedure for the disciplinary bodies,
mm-hmm.
but the procedure for disciplinary action. It's got nothing to do with the time period for lodging a complaint for citizens. But then at the same time, if you look at clause 95, it talks about the manner and form in which complaints of misconduct. Clause 95F is on page 85.
Mm-hmm.
It talks about the manner and form in which complaints of misconduct relating to legal practitioners must be lodged with. But again, manner and form has got nothing to do with time. Just so that everybody must know, if I have a complaint, I only have so many days to lodge that complaint so that we don't take 5 years and then all of a sudden my emotions are stirred up again and I want to lodge that complaint.
How would anyone know that you have a complaint?
No, what I'm saying is I might be aggrieved by...
I'll sit with it and stew for a couple of years.
And then after that...
And then say, no. I've thought about now I'm
going to must, yes, so that's what I'm saying. I think it must just be clear somewhere about the time.
Oh, that's good.
In the rules that must just be called maybe clause S, then that must just make reference also to the time period instead of just format and...
Who will determine when the time period kicks in? That's the point I'm trying to make this up.
Why do you really feel aggrieved?
No, that's the point I'm trying to make. Ah, no, that's, yeah, but... Right, let's think about this.
Is there maybe, currently, when it comes to attorneys or advocates, is there a time period?
Time period? now?
Yeah, we'll find out and inform the committee actually what is the position.
No, I concede to what she's saying, except that, you know,
time period there, during which a complaint is to be lodged. I've never heard that a complaint was sent to us.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's some periods to sue.
Well, that's clear, well, say.
Not in all cases.
Not in all cases. Let me hear you, Ms. Plevenshaw.
No, I'm actually thinking that probably what Honorable Adams is right about could be something that's about enabling those to be part of the rules, not something that has got a position in the future.
Perhaps you can just insert an enabling provision in that subclause 6 that Honourable Adams referred to, so that the council can sort it out, as you said, when does it start, when does it end, just to alert them to the issue of time.
Yeah, I'm just worried about clients being done in by virtue of the fact that, well, at the time they didn't think it was necessary. Well, 2 years later they say, I really think I was done here now, and I think thought about it and come to certain facts have been brought to my attention, and I want to bring a complaint. Mm-hmm. No, leave it to the rules board. Okay, all right. Okay. Yeah, either the council or the rules board. Okay. Okay, we've done disciplinary body, so we understand now. Complaint is lodged at the regional council level, and it's then processed and fed up to the legal practice council. It's better processed.
Chair, should we have an option, or to this effect, or just for the drafting point?
Isn't that what it says now?
It starts with
make it clear.
Well, now it's lodged with a region and goes up to the council. Is that?
All right, do you have an option?
What happened? along the line of delay matter. Is it a reason why? What is the reason why we're thinking about this? There's 2,000 systems of which only 200. Yes, then you ask yourself.
I think that the charges are going to be There's more to life than that. I know.
I'm going to go to the hospital.
because I need to be in external city, and also to be in upper city. Okay, so I'll only say after my son is, because I'm not planning to set particular
offense. No, no, not for lunch.
So this guy is just there.
No, it's
not. Well, that doesn't have been there. That doesn't have been there. Just outside. And it takes long for the phone to ring. It's the aircon. This aircon is making our hair blow even though it's...
No, the aircon is fine. I think we should just know.
The front manager said when they asked him that was his passport, and then he said, no, it's not this.
But do you know that it's white wine, it's not red wine?
I don't know.
Which one?
White.
White.
Yeah. Even though white looks lighter and thin.
Yeah.
I'm talking about my yema that's been linked up, so I'm saying to you that the Omone is
white wine,
not red wine.
Oh.
White wine has more calories
than
the red wine. So you see all these people that... You must just wait for the QA from generations as well, since it's going to look like it.
I don't know that water.
No, I'm just joking. I'm not drinking for real.
That's
water. It's light verbal tea that makes the color.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
So that's the... It's not... Yes, but okay, it's okay, but I will tell you afterwards. Apple was this, Apple phone and then Apple computer. Then it was, so all these products are designed because you will buy more of that same kit. For something I think, and some of the things that a word document from here, you will get instructed on other people's emails. Because from here it's my
choice.
And then I have to call, okay, I'll go and have it on my proper laptop, and then I can send it from here.
So get in a package.
Don't think that these are... I know that, but I
think that
is now I was only the contract that you have to...
No, you can't. You won't get a client. You can't get a way. You've got to change your...
The contract. But I
was
written so there's a lot of things.
You want a contract? I want to know you're coming to me.
No.
Well, look, I went to a
Thank you. Honourable members, just a bit of housework before we begin again. We'll stop at around about 1-ish, 10 to 1. We unfortunately on Thursday have a caucus. I don't know about you guys. We do, and so please forgive us. We'll meet in the afternoon on Thursday. Mr. Dagger, I'm sorry to do this to you, but it's out of my hands. I can't say to my organization, morning. Yes. Well, what I said to them is they sent me off to. All right. We'll start at 2. Yeah. 2 to 4. Yeah. 4. All right. Okay.
Chairperson?
Yes.
I just want to know, are we meeting tomorrow? Because the document that Banani sent says that, but on Parliament's program, there's a BRRR workshop.
No, yes, it you should be there, and I'm sincerely hoping you don't say to me, well, I want to be there. Christine has to be there, but she's making a presentation. We have been given permission to sit as a committee. Yes. So we're excluded all right? As I said, unless you insist that, well, I want to be there, listen to people, Arctic. I still don't understand why it's all happening at this stage. Okay. No, don't encourage me, Christine. Okay. All right. Okay. Let's get back to more important matters. Slow. Are we done with 37?
Chair, there is still in sub-clause 3, there was a small insertion that the chairperson of a disciplinary committee can't be a live person.
Yes.
And then sub-clause 4 was also amended. To insert practicable and also just the rewording, and then also the insertion of the advocate and attorney and the layperson.
Okay.
And in the footnote it says that regarding this matter, the section 25 of the Judicial Service Commission was used. And the question of remuneration of laypersons need to be discussed, and who will compile this list. Perhaps the Ombuds or the Council and the BC's guidance is requested here.
You in a position to say anything?
I'm tempted to go with the Ombud, but I'm sure that I haven't thought it through.
Yeah.
I'm tempted to go with the Ombud, who now on our alternative option, which I suspect we'll go with,
play their classic ombuds function, but also has the right to keep, by the way, an eye, which I think we should keep, has the right to keep an eye on disciplinary proceedings. I still remain of the firm view that this person should be a retired judge, although I think the option we've been given is not bad. But especially if it's a retired judge, you have instantly a kind of public trust, and I think one could happily leave it to that ombuds, he or she, to compile the list.
Anybody else? All right, it doesn't look like we're in a position to give you an answer now. But we noted that.
Thank you, Chair. The next new in session was in Clause 38 that deals with the procedure for dealing with compliance and misconduct. The proposed insertion was in Subclause 3. Particulars of all disciplinary hearings, including the particulars of, and then the allegations, the members of the disciplinary committee, and then the legal practitioners or juridic entities or private legal practitioners involved, and then also must subject to Section 4A, the public, etc., and then 4A, the proceedings of hearings are open to the public, and then the chairperson or presiding officer of the disciplinary committee directs otherwise. Yes, and then also the reference to the Criminal Procedure Act, and in the footnotes, those two sections of the Criminal Procedure Act is quoted for your convenience, and also the Honourable Committee requested us to find out how it works with the medical profession. The Health Professions Council of South Africa's professional conduct inquiries are open to the public and the media unless closed at the discretion of the chairperson.
Which is such a giant thing, I can never find the right page in it.
So, in sub 3, sub 3D, Roman 3, relevant question by members of the public during business hours. This is the person's website. During business hours?
It is a separate provision, Chair. It is on the website as well as available at the offices. It's two options for the public. If you don't have access, you can visit the office.
Yeah, visit the office. Yeah, okay.
Relevant to relevant in Roman 3.
Yes.
I'm not talking about every regional council. So, sorry.
Relevant. Okay. Okay.
Chair, then in subclause 4B, this was an insertion to be made here that the complainant is made in prison.
As to the use of the CPA, Chair?
CPA? Yes.
For the report, sir? I think what a necessary change is the most wonderful phrase ever invented in the English language. Yes, but with reference to that CPA, sections 50, whatever, 3 and 4, what a necessary change is, wonderfully clear. So, I mean, unless somebody with more devotion speaking on the subject of whether using the 153 and 4 of CPA with the necessary changes is the right instrument to use to assist the presiding officer. I'm tempted to go with this. With the necessary changes, but that's wonderful.
Okay.
Should we then delete on Route Caution? Or I'm not sure clear on that. Shall it remain there?
No, it stays there.
Subclause 8 was moved to the clause that deals with the offences, clause 93.
Okay.
Clause 40, proceeded after disciplinary hearing and sanctions. Subclause 3, if found guilty of misconduct, the disciplinary committee concerned my call witnesses, and then there was insertion in round 1. Put it into pay compensation, subject to confirmation of the court on application by counsel, which was to clarify, and in Roman 2, the fine is payable to the counsel. This is for the committee's consideration.
Money that I'm always worried about, because the legal practitioners are also worried that this thing is going to cost. I mean, it's the objection in every country where reform has occurred. There's one way to get money, and we've provided the body that's going to benefit from these fines, counsel, is not in charge of the disciplinaries, so that there's no suggestion that they might have an interest. And there, the addition of the layperson to the trio helps, doesn't it? Where else would the money go? Legal aid. Oh, it could go to legal aid. No, I think.
No, legal aid just pay over to the course. It's fair.
I'm sorry, Jay. I might have had a weak moment when this matter was discussed.
Mm-hmm.
I seem to have recalled that the argument was that the attorneys are not being the complainants sometimes out of pocket, and this is not on, and we should do something about it, and there should be compensation awards in favor of the complainants.
Yes, the compensation is dealt with further on in the clause on the sub B on page 49. In the case of the juristic entity to pay compensation. Wait a minute. It's compensation, yeah. For the aim or her to pay compensation. There it is under A Roman 1.
Yes,
it's different options, yes.
Yes, it's different options.
Yes. It's compensation or a fine or a suspension, and it's similar in B, it's paragraph B for juridic entity and C for legal practitioner.
Yeah. Sure, no, it's fine. Okay. Anything else on the rumors? Nothing? Things slow? Oh, sorry.
Yes.
question on that, then sub-clause 8 was deleted. Because this clause is unnecessary if the department's proposal in clause 38.3 is accepted, and 38.3 relates to the particulars of the hearings that are published. So the committee requested that it be deleted here. The next one is clause 42, appeal against conduct orders or findings. Chairperson?
Sorry,
if I can just go back to page 49B1, in the case of the Euroski person, isn't that also supposed to end up the same as 3A1?
On application by the council.
3A1, which is circumstances of prescribed manner on application by the council, and when it comes to the heuristic entity, is also on application by the council. So I think those words have just been omitted there.
Yep.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Adams.
Section, so clause 2B, there was an insertion at the request of the committee. The members of the appeal tribunal must be at least one advocate, one attorney, and one lay person.
Okay. Comments, questions, Ben? Okay.
Next one is clause 47, objects of ombud.
Excuse me, I don't want to deal with the question on 43, or have we concluded? Monitoring of by legal personnel. Ombud may monitor the investigation of a complaint. And on your footnote, you required our guidance. Do you not want to deal with that because it's not an underlying?
Well, yes, we've noted it. I thought Mrs. Lowe had mentioned it.
But I think it looks alright, doesn't it?
Yes. May not be persons who were involved in any investigation, blah, blah, blah.
Mm. Friend of self-evident, no doubt it needed saying.
Okay. What are you wanting us to do under 43 or SMAS?
No, I just noticed that the PC's guidance is asked in footnote 250.
Yes.
As to whether the ombud may monitor the investigation of complaints and the conduct of disciplinary committees. I think as the ombud is a retired judge, it does absolutely no harm. It's not a bad idea.
Clause, I think, Chair, I think the clause relating to the functions of the ombud in that yes.
Presumes that they can then go and say, well, I'm not happy with the investigation, Chris.
I'm not happy with this, and then the ombud kicks in there at that stage already and intervenes and delays the process. I'm purely looking, I haven't formulated a specific view yet, but I'm just trying to think that we need to keep the processes separate. It would be probably just thinking schematically that it is probably better for the ombud to play that review process once the body is finished, so that a complainant that is unhappy doesn't have to go to court to go and have the whole process reviewed, and can go to the ombud. But I'm not opposed to an idea of the ombud kicking in if there's some procedural difficulty along the way. I'm just trying to get the idea, are we not going to have undue delays with the process if either can complain to the ombud that there's either the complainant or even the attorney that's been disciplined, he's also got the right to go to the ombud and ask the process ongoing. So we just need to be aware when we get to the powers of the ombud, do we want to keep the two bodies totally separate when it comes to disciplinary matters, or do we want the ombud to intervene as the process is going on? And maybe we can look at other structures that have got an ombud. At what stage does the ombud kick in?
I'm trying to proofread the section of the ombud, and in my mind we had a clause that said you need to exhaust all the available legal processes before you go to the ombud. In my mind I know we have that. I'm trying to find that clause and keep with this that allows to come back to on this one.
Sir, but that was one of the issues that we also identified internally. I'm hoping that it's there and we'll be able to identify. We just flag that.
Yeah.
And what material also surely is what we used to have a power of review, and I thought we'd kind of started moving in the direction of the appeal mechanism, and then we wouldn't have to. But let's discuss it.
You see under 49H.
Yes.
49H says make any time.
The review is set aside.
Right.
Right. 49H says, may at any time prior to, during, or after investigation. So, that power to intervene is there. Oh no. Bring to the matter to the notice of the NPA. Okay, sorry. I was reading for the moment. Oh, here we are. May issues of the opinion prosecution. Okay. Is it advisable for any matter to be proof of body? Okay. Prejudice. Summon designates. No, I don't see it, Mr. Day.
So the ombud can intervene
at any stage. Now, I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing.
I'm not saying that he or she can intervene.
But
he or she can refer a matter to the relevant authority, right? Which in most cases will either be the police or the NPA.
Yes, I think that is possibly very grounds.
Which doesn't address the concern you raised.
I don't know if it's a real concern.
Well, let's just flag it.
Yeah.
Okay. What Mr. Swart is saying, in the middle of a disciplinary hearing, the complainant can leave, go to the ombud, and say, they're messing me around. In that situation, does mean the ombud can be intervened? Well,
because the ombud is a referee. If processes are not legally followed and the complainant says that at that point they need to report the matter to the ombudsman who's a referee. Maybe just to put things in perspective, not to say that it's going to stop the process from unfolding.
social justice has in it and the field of procedure. So recognition that looked at it. We have a disciplinary hearing that can find you guilty. You appeal against that finding to the appeal committee, which what the committee has done has ensured that there's not a system of any persons that made up any of the prior committees, so that it's seen as being independent and the inclusion of the lay person. And I would imagine that to prevent the flurry of referrals to the office of the Ombud until the appeal procedure is finalized, that the intention would be for those internal mechanisms to be exhausted.
Yeah. I like
So you expose yourself to an unfair process until it's over?
Well, yes, but then even the disciplinary hearing will be aware of the fact that you have the right to appeal to the Ombud. So, you know, that itself will give them pause and ensure that they do things properly. Am I right, Mrs. Swart?
As it is presently formulated,
yeah,
the Ombud can intervene at any point. Because if you look at 491B, may his own accord or on receipt of a complaint investigate any failure by a disciplinary body so you could to deal promptly, effectively or fairly. So
after each point.
Then at that point, yeah. At that point. You can then go and say, look, you have
taken at that point.
Well, you may of his own accord on receipt of a complaint. There's nothing to prevent you. You're in the middle of a hearing as the complainant and you feel that this has taken it's taken 2 weeks, which the disciplinary panel might think is reasonable, but you say it's not prompted. You feel, and now you lodge a complaint to the Ombud. That's it. And you
say that the Ombud should go for the process.
Well, that's a debate we need to have, because do we want the Ombud to interfere? And maybe we do. I'm just saying we need to understand what we are legislating, that we're giving the power to Ombud as this formulator. Mr. Dye, if you look carefully at the wording, promptly. Effectively, so you might, in your own view, believe that the disciplinary panel is not dealing. I remember you're complaining, you're very emotional about the issue, and you think they're not dealing effectively.
Well, or fairly, as it says.
Fairly is more objective. Yeah, but effectively, you say, but you're not dealing effectively, I'm going to Ombud now. The Ombud can, at that point, intervene and say, I need to look, are you dealing with it fairly, effectively, or promptly? Right. And then that delays the process. So maybe a complainant wouldn't do that because you know that's going to delay the finalisation of his case. That's just something we need to be aware of.
You feel, Chair, the matter has been dragged, and as it gets dragged, it actually complicates your life for whatever reason, and you want to actually have the ombudsman coming in to intervene so that the matter can be concluded. So if you are exposed to an unfair process, the ombudsman
well, it's precisely because we're so gender sensitive at negotiations that we, ombudsman is obviously the international phrase, that we ended up using a completely different phrase, public protector, which I've often thought, what if pretty, because I don't know what we mean in ombud, and people get all confused. But it's because ombudsman and the ombudsperson is such too clumsy, that's why we call the public protector the public protector. But Chairman, on the same point, if you now look at not 49.1 as it was, but alternative to 49.1, which I rather thought is what we're going to do, because we've now got to
develop. Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Now, on the same matter, in 1A, in addition to other parts, blah, 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 the ombud is competent to investigate on his or her own initiative or receipt of a complaint any alleged inter alia abuse or unjustifiable exercise of power, unfair, other improper conduct or undue delay in performing a function in terms of this act. So there might be some foot dragging at an investigation or act or omission which results in unlawful or improper prejudice. Another example. See, at any time, prior to, during, or after an investigation, this is not an investigation, it's not a hearing, referred to in paragraph A,
the ombud may, if he or she is of the opinion that the fact disclosed is commission of an offence, then you go to the prosecutions. Two, deems it advisable to refer any matter which has bearing on an investigation to the appropriate body or authority. Three, is of the opinion that there is substance in any complaint made and that the prejudice of the complainant is substantial, has the potential of affecting the integrity and independence, blah, 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 blah. Then you go to the competent court. And a B, it's not a, B, the ombuds may try to resolve disputes or rectify actual revisions by mediation, conciliation, negotiation, and advising the person. Doesn't that imply that if a complainant found or the accused, that may be, find they feel very strongly that their disciplinary is being either delayed or incorrectly conducted or whatever, that they all can step in to mediate, conciliate and negotiate. Does it mean that?
Further down on the C on the G. Prejudice of a complaint on the person, blah, blah, substantial there. Do anything necessary to enable the proceedings to be taken to a competent court.
Court.
It's a worrying power, because on the one hand, because we're looking at this in isolation, the rules to be promulgated that this uncertain situation could be saying must have specific time frames. Cannot be any delays, and I wish this to be specific, so that anyone can understand how this can happen, how the agency, and what the full impact of this process will be every step of the way. So we are looking at this in isolation of that subsidy, because if we had that already, we would have had the hindsight of, well, this process is absolutely good. You know, it's only going to take 3 months from A to Z, including the appeal. I'm using that as an example. So we're looking at this in total isolation, but I must imagine the rules are going to be specific to ensure that there isn't any delays.
If you have the operating scheme, then that's another. And just another issue here is, of course, the accused lawyer. There's nothing to prevent him at any stage saying, I have not been dealt with fairly, or I have not been dealt with effectively in the middle of the hearing, and referring it to the ombud as a delay tactic. And that, of course, then the ombud has to ask for a record of the proceedings, go through it, come and mediate, and I think that may well be just a delay tactic. And the rules say this. The split hearing must be done, but it can't. The ombud will not be able to respond and get the transcript and go through that within that period. So I don't know, Chair, it's just another issue we need to just bear in mind. And I think the Dyer's point is correct. We don't know the rules, so we need to tighten that up when we see the whole scheme of how this is developing.
No, I'm becoming persuaded because, procedural impropriety can also be the subject of the appeal we take afterwards. So we've now created the appeal mechanism. All right. Okay. ANC members are keen to do parliamentary questions to the Minister of Justice. I think all of them have questions.
Jefferson, I don't need to take you to page 48.
48?
Yes.
Okay.
Appointment of the
ombud? Yes.
So who should appoint them?
Oh. Where is that?
Remember the role of the ombud recommendations. Simply to the council.
The
So your view on this dilemma, Jack, is that the president should be involved in the event.
And then also from all other sections, like the nation also, when you look at the president, the president is subject to subjection to the nation.
I feel very strongly that the Ombud should be a retired judge. It just takes care of many problems. A retired judge, because he's a judge, is above reproach, and we won't have any further difficulties. Now, in your expert view, what is the exact desirable avenue in this case? That it should be the president? I agree, absolutely, it should be. Should it be in concurrence on the advice of the Chief Justice? Because I think the CJA has got to be. What to your taste? You just sketch to us different smart. What would be proper in this scenario?
Yeah, when the government is involved in the
judges and what's that other category called? Discharge from service.
Discharge
as you can see, as Chaplain XC said, who may be called? And that's a judge this requires at 7.
Yes.
Okay. So those ones are not released from the bondage.
Yes.
Because you have served 20 years, if you have served 50 years, and you're about the age of 65, you may ask the person to release you from FGC. And while you have done so, you may be called for a period of the minimum 3 months area. So you are not entirely straight. Then the judge who's aside from FGC, who falls outside the 70, who may not be called, but can volunteer themselves.
Does this
have
This is how the SC is very difficult.
Yeah.
Yes, that's true. No, I'm terrified what you said. And therefore, they're so difficult, and therefore they would not be desirable as an ombud.
No. But I think if I'm
an ombud, it might find it difficult to actually have to be called. To call the SCs to come in account.
Yeah.
That's what you're saying.
Yes.
Because we've got various categories. And you have a judge, a discharged from active service, admitted an admitted advocate, an attorney, qualified to be admitted as advocate and attorney,
and
specialized knowledge and experience of cumulative period. I'm sure you can make sure can become a the list, the categories can nominate. But then what are you saying? Are you saying some of the categories can might find it difficult to execute work? But then why do we actually make a provision that almost has a problem already?
That raised it last time about post 48 about the retired judge.
Mm.
We must just keep in mind that the period is 7 years or even 14 years. If we talk about the retired judge, I mean, it seems like the person might even be up to 84 years old.
And he'll still be working as an
I mean, sickness, health.
There were the sellers forgotten that we mentioned Kate O'Regan and Yvonne.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think we should make it 7 years anyway. That's the usual independent, your standard for independent security of 7 years.
Ms. Adams is still speaking. Yes. And in fairness to her, she makes an important point. But if you take a judge who has now already reached 70, he's retired, and you make him an omen, When he reaches 84, he's still going to be facing these terribly difficult SCs. That's the point she's making.
My proposal is, if we want to keep this about the retired judge, then we should at least have up until a specific age. Only for retired judge, but when it comes to the other, it can be seven years or 14 years, because then age is not a problem. But only when it's about a retired judge, which might create the impression that we are thinking about a specific judge, but at least for up until a specific age.
Yeah. And or a period of service which is more realistic.
Mm.
5 years.
Yes. Mr. Simone, you're only thinking of himself. He's thinking ahead. He's thinking ahead. So. I'm teasing. All right, we'll think about it. 5 years renewable. 70-75. And he has staff supporting him. I know. All right, it's something we need to think about in Flabby, notwithstanding the proposal you've made. Okay. But I think what Mr. Spasella has helped us to do is focus our minds on the fact that if we do go the route of a retired judge, then these are the implications. Yes. Okay. Can we break for lunch and reconvene at 2, please? It's 1 o'clock or 7.
Thank you.